Welcome, everybody. This is the second lecture of our second course on Man, Economy, and State, Production in the Market Process. We're broadcasting here. Let me adjust the screen to get some of that light out of your eyes. I'm broadcasting from the top floor of the Mises Institute down here for Mises University. Okay, so tonight what we're doing is we're going through, I'm calling it the first half of Chapter 6 of Man, Economy, and State, but as you'll see when we go through it, really what I'm going to do, I'm going to start out doing that. I'm going to explain that very important diagram that's early on in Chapter 6, but then the last chunk of tonight's lecture, I'm going to sort of do freestyle, deviate from the text a little bit, and just give you my version of interest theory in the Austrian tradition. All right, so it's consistent with the stuff that Rothbard is doing in this first half of the chapter, but I think it's going to be easier if I explain it that way. And then after you see my lecture, some of the stuff Rothbard's talking about will make more sense. Either way, by next week when we do the officially assigned second half of Chapter 6, I will have covered for you guys anything important from Chapter 6 that I want you to know. But my point is just this particular lecture, it's not going to be following the text as closely as most of the other stuff that I do with you. All right, so what are the assumptions? So here Rothbard, so right now I am following Chapter 6 closely. In the beginning, Rothbard explains what is he doing here. So if you remember in Chapter 5, he was getting us warmed up. And he was starting out assuming that it was joint ownership, meaning that even though there were physically or from an engineering point of view, there might be various stages of the raw materials getting transformed step by step, getting more natural resources flowing into them, having people use their labor powers on them and transform them step by step until eventually finished consumer goods shot out the other end of the pipeline. Even though conceptually you could split them up into stages, the idea was there wasn't money constantly changing hands from different buyers at each stage. It was just everybody who contributed would kind of wait for the thing to be made, and then they would split up the money. And then the other major assumption he made in Chapter 5 was that every factor was assumed to be completely specific. So that meant that every factor was useful only in the production of one particular good. Now each good could was created with a combination of more than one input. So for every output good that you saw, it had at least two inputs and possibly many more. But the point was any particular input or productive factor only was useful in producing one thing. That's the idea. And that was just to keep the analysis simple. So now in this chapter, we're going to relax those two assumptions. So there's going to be capitalists who come in at each stage and buy whatever the product is at that stage, then have more labor power and natural resources go into it, and then they sell it to some other capitalist. That's the way it's going to work. And also the factors now are going to be of varying specificities, so that some machine might be useful in several different lines. Okay. The other thing, this is actually the first paragraph here, what we're working on in Chapter 6 is the explanation of what Rothbard calls the pure rate of interest. It's due just to time preference. So later on in Man, Economy, and State, you're going to deal with the fact that the complications that in the real world, the actual, what appears to be the actual market rate of interest is going to have several components in it. And so one of it is what's called the pure rate, and that's due just to time preference. But then there's at least two other categories. One is the purchasing power premium, and that's because if you expect prices to go up by 10%, then you might insist as a lender on a higher contractual market rate of interest for lending money out, because the money you're going to get paid back in is going to be have less purchasing power than the money that you lent out. And so that's the purchasing power component. And then also there's like a risk component, that if you're investing in AAA corporate bonds versus if you're lending money to some company that's going to do some really reckless project, then you might insist on a higher rate of return on those two different loans. So there, the fact that you're going to get a higher rate of return, a higher interest rate, if you will, higher yield on the very risky project as compared to the lending to the company that has a AAA rating on its bonds, that's, you're not going to explain that difference due to time preference. Clearly, that has to do with the fact that you're less likely to get your money back if you lend to the riskier project. So again, what Rothbard's talking about in this chapter is he's assuming that prices are not fluctuating because of changes in the quantity of money or changes in the demand to hold money, and there's not uncertainty in this. Right. So one way of putting it is what we're going to be studying right now is the ERE. That what we're really going to do is look at an economy that is in a stationary state. If you want to think of it this way, say it's in the evenly rotating economy position, then we're going to figure out what is the interest rate, what things can we say about the interest rate in that environment. So remember, there still is interest in the evenly rotating economy because interest, the Austrians say, is due to time preference. And even in the evenly rotating economy, even though people are perfectly certain, they still have time preference. They still prefer to get goods sooner rather than later. Just like in the evenly rotating economy, people would rather eat a hamburger than eat rat poison. And so that's why a restaurant serving hamburgers is going to be able to charge a higher price than a restaurant serving rat poison. By the same token, people still have preferences. Even though in the ERE everything repeats itself, people still have subjective preferences, and they prefer to get a hamburger today rather than getting a hamburger delivered 3 years from now. And so that's why you're still going to have interest in the evenly rotating economy. So that's really what we're doing in this chapter, is we're saying, okay, everything is constant, everything repeats itself time period after time period, and so let's look at these equilibrium price ratios between various stages of production, and what can we say? All right, so this is a crucial diagram. I'm going to spend a lot of time on this. And let me, have they posted this yet? So the TAs who are tuned in right now, I did send that this PowerPoint about 5 minutes ago. So if you can check that email and see if you can post this, this will help people, because this is definitely a PowerPoint you want to have locally in case you need to flip back and look at this chart when I'm not looking at it. Okay, so let me get my pointer going. Like I say, brace yourselves, because we're going to spend some time on this chart, and let me just explain why. It is crucial that you understand this. This, a lot of what we do in this whole course is going to revolve around the concepts that are succinctly illustrated in a chart like this. So that's why I'm going to spend so much time on it, and why I really want you to know how this thing works. It's a little bit tricky at first. You might get, especially if you're looking at it with fresh eyes, you might forget how to get going with it. But once you do, it's pretty straightforward. And it's kind of neat the way Rothbard did this, because he actually, I think, adapted a little bit what Hayek was doing. And I think that there's a lot of information and a lot about the Austrian view of capital structure and interest that you can get in Graham. So that it's kind of neat. All right, so let me just walk you through it. So you might realize that this looks kind of like the one that we did in Chapter 5, except now there's this whole column that's new of interest income. So let me explain what's going on here. So again, 100 ounces, the consumers every period spend 100 ounces of gold on the finished consumption goods. So there's 100 ounces worth of consumption every period. And that's, so this C stands for the final stage good, the first order good, the consumption good. And then this one, I'm going to have to check Rothbard's terminology. I'm not sure why. I had always said that a second order good was a good that produced the lowest order, the consumer good, but I don't know why Rothbard's putting a one there. But anyway, what's happening here? So for one thing, let me make sure you don't get mixed up. You see over here, this 1, 2, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's not that 2 is on purpose, the double 2. So this isn't like stages of production. So don't get mixed up there. I kind of wish Rothbard had chosen his numbers a little bit differently, because if you look at it quickly, you might think, oh, this is the first stage, this is the second stage, and you go down here, the fifth stage. That's not what's going on. Remember, the stages go up. So the lower order stages, the ones towards consumption, and then the higher order stages means you're higher and higher up. You're more remote from consumption. Okay, so there's no reason that these numbers should almost look like they're sequential. It's just a coincidence. And in particular, that's why there's a double two there. Okay, but those numbers don't need to be going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's just a coincidence. They need to be ascending, but they don't need to be doing it in that nice orderly fashion like that. Okay, what else do we say about this? Okay, so remember here, this 100 ounces, this is the consumer good level. The consumers spend 100 ounces on consumption each period. Now, where do those consumption goods, consumer goods come from? Well, there's these capitalists here at this stage, and what do they do? Well, what they do every period, they take 80 ounces of gold and they buy the capital good from the guys above them. And they also, and that costs them 80 ounces, they also spend 15 ounces of gold hiring workers and buying natural resources. And then they take those capital goods. And remember, the capital goods, you might be thinking like it's a hammer or something, but no, it's also the goods in process. So if the final, I should probably make up something so that we have something concrete to work with. If the final thing here is loaves of bread that are on the grocery store shelf, and that's the consumers that are spending 100 ounces of gold each period buying loaves of bread, what the capitalists here in this stage are getting maybe is the loaf of bread before it's sliced, and they're getting the plastic from some other company. And then what the 15 that they're spending on is they're hiring some workers, and they're also getting it's going to be hard for me to come up with a natural resource. Well, okay, they're paying the landowner, because their plant, their wholesale operation sits on land. So they have to pay rent to a landlord. So there's somebody who owns the land on which this wholesaler has his operation. So he's hiring the workers using their bare hands. They take the loaves of bread, and then they have a knife, and they cut up the bread into loaves or into slices, and they put it in the plastic bag, and then they tie it up, and then that's so they've turned the capital goods with the input of labor and some land, they've turned that into the finished good, which is a finished loaf of bread that the consumer gets. That's nicely sliced and it's in the nice packaging. Okay, so when I say that those 80 ounces of gold in this stage go to buy capital goods, don't just be thinking of tractors and 18-wheelers and telescopes and stuff like that. Capital goods, remember, can also refer to goods in process, like inventories. So they're not consumer goods yet, because the people who own them are viewing them as a means to an end. And they're going to actually transform them a little bit before giving them to the consumer. Now, I see people asking in the questions here, aren't isn't the factory itself, the whole, the building that this operation is occurring in, isn't that a capital good? If they're if the workers are using some sort of knife, isn't that a capital good? Yes. The answer to all those questions is yes. The Austrian framework, especially for this level of the analysis, it's actually going to be easier if you try not to think about capital goods as being durable tools. Okay, just trust me right now. Try to not think of it like that because you're going to get screwed up. Think of it instead as just stuff that keeps changing hands. That it's the wheat gets turned into the flour. The flour gets turned into a big loaf of bread, and then the loaf of bread gets sliced up and then packaged, and then that's it. Okay, so don't think of it in terms of, don't think of the big oven that's just sitting there and bread flows through it, and the oven stays there at stage three. You're going to get screwed up. Don't think of it like, later on, of course, you're going to have to incorporate that, because in the real world, we do have what's called fixed capital goods. But I'm saying right now, to get the spirit of the Austrian approach to this, just think of the capital goods as moving down the stream. And at each stage, the workers work on them, transform them, put in some more natural resources, and then they move on. Okay. So at this stage, remember, the 80 ounces is what they pay to the guys selling them to the bakers who sell them the loaf of bread that hasn't been cut up, and they pay so maybe they pay 70 for that bread, and they pay 10 to the company that makes the plastic wrapping that they put the bread in when it's done, and maybe the little twist tie thing. Okay, so they spend 80 ounces of gold buying capital goods produced by other companies. And then the 15 ounces, they pay some of it to the workers, and they pay some of it to the landowner, the person that owns the real estate that it's sitting on. All right. So then the next stage, you've got what happens. I'm not going to go through the whole thing here. Let me just do one more to make sure we get the pattern. The next stage, what goes on? Well, remember, the we're talking here now about this, the people that are in the business of selling the bread and the plastic. So how do they do that? And they get 80 ounces for it. So how do they do that? Well, they themselves each period spend 60 ounces buying capital goods. So maybe at this stage we're talking about the bakers. So they spend 60 ounces getting the flour from the miller, okay? And then they also spend 16 ounces of gold on workers and other raw materials. Okay, so if I keep doing this, I'm gonna run out of stages. So let me just jump up to the top here. The highest order capitalists, what do? Each period, they give 19 ounces to workers and the owners of natural resources, and they don't buy capital goods from anybody. So these workers, with their bare hands, directly go out and pick wheat from the field or something and then give it to somebody else. Okay, because, again, it's, if you're thinking that they're using tools, well, then the tools have to come from somewhere, and so the analysis can't stop there. Okay, so that's part of the problem. That's what some critics say, but just trust me, in order to get the story down straight, first you want to think of it as these guys at this top stage, they are just using pure labor and pure land without any contribution of capital goods at all. And so just imagine, since we're trying to make bread as the final thing, maybe you want to think of it as workers going out into the field and just grabbing wheat with their bare hands. Or if you want, you can imagine this first stage, workers going out with their bare hands and going into a forest and grabbing sticks and grabbing sharp rocks, and then they combine them with vines or something, or I don't know what, seaweed, and make a sort of cutting instrument. And then the next stage, workers buy those cutting instruments and go out and then use it to harvest the wheat more efficiently. And the cutting instruments break every period. And so they got to get new ones each period. Okay, you can do it that way if you want. But the point is, the people in this top stage here, they're not using tools. They're using their raw labor power and raw gifts of nature that have not been augmented by human beings in the past. Because that's what we're trying to do here, is we're trying to isolate how capital goods come into the picture and how they augment labor and natural resources. Okay, so again, at this top stage here, this sixth stage, every period they pay 19 ounces to landowners. And remember, when I say landowners, I don't just mean real estate. That means anybody who owns natural resources, the gifts of nature. So everything in nature that's scarce is owned by somebody, and that person then can command a market rent for it by selling it. So if it's like a stream that gives pure water that people want to drink, you know, clean water, and there's not enough of the water around, then there's a market price for it, then the owner can charge for that. Or if there's somebody who owns a lake that's got fish in it and people want to go out and go fishing, that's fine too, and the owner of the lake can charge them and say, okay, for all the fish you take out, you pay me a certain amount. The only thing is, if we're in the evenly rotating economy and you're talking about a fishery, you got to make sure that the people only take out every period the exact amount of fish that are the net increase in the population, so that the population of fish stays the same period after period, and the output of fish can last indefinitely. So you just got to be careful that way. So again, the point there is, this word land is a generic term meaning natural resources. It doesn't just mean the physical ground space. Okay, so they do that 19 ounces every period, and then they turn around 1 year later or one time period later and sell that good in process for 20 ounces to the next stage. Then those people take that capital good, they spend 8 ounces to buy more workers and more labor, or sorry, more natural resources, and then they turn around and sell that thing for 30. And then the guy who has it for 30 spends 13, and then after the time period is over and those workers use the new natural resources developing this thing that they paid 30 for, now turn around and can sell the good in process for 45, and so on. So at each stage, the thing gets more and more valuable. So if you were, you know, adopting a cost theory of value, you would say, oh yeah, it's because they keep putting more and more resources into it, so that's why the market price goes up. But as Austrians, we realize that no, it's the other way around. As this thing gets processed more and more and keeps getting handed off to the next capitalist, it's getting closer and closer to being the finished consumer good. So the reason the consumers spend 100 ounces of gold on all these loaves of bread is just because of their subjective preferences. They're hungry, and they see that thing, and they realize, oh, that can satisfy my hunger, so that's why I'm willing to pay money for it. And in the aggregate, they spend 100 ounces of gold on it. So there's no mystery there as to why the consumers are spending that much on the loaves of bread. The mystery is, why do the capitalists at this stage, why are they willing to spend 80 ounces of gold on, you know, the hunk of bread and the plastic? It's not because, oh, all the resources that are in it. No. They're forward-looking. They realize, oh, if we have that hunk of bread and that plastic, I realize, you know, given my technology, I can go out and spend 15 more ounces of gold hiring some workers and paying somebody to give me this land space, and then I can get an operation going. I could spend a total of 95, and then one time period from now, I would have sliced loaves of bread nicely bundled in plastic wrap that I could sell to people, I'm guessing, for 100 ounces. All right, so that's where these capital valuations are coming from. The entrepreneurs in each stage are looking forward one step and saying, ah, I'm estimating, I'm forecasting the demand for the lower order good here, and that determines how much I would be willing to pay for this capital good, because I know I have the technology at my disposal to hire some workers and more natural resources, transform it a little bit, make it better, and then hand it off. And when we say better, we mean closer to being a finished loaf of bread that the consumer's willing to pay 100 ounces for. That's what's going on. So the reason there's a market for this capital good here at this stage is that it's almost a loaf of bread for the consumer. So that's why you're willing to pay so much for it, is because it's almost there. There's not much more you have to do to physically transform those capital goods into the finished retail product that you know there's a market for. But then the same thing here, these capital goods that sell for 60, the reason they sell for 60 is they're almost there. They're almost able to be turned into something that can sell, that you know can sell for 80. You just have to add, you just have to be willing to spend 16 more ounces of gold to hire some workers and to get some natural resources, and then you can transform these things into something that you can sell for 80. Okay, so now it starts to get real interesting. You say, okay, but what specifically is going on with these capitalists at each stage? Why are they doing this? What's in it for them? It's because if you look at the numbers, you can see they are actually earning more than they're spending, or than they're investing. So let's maybe it's easy. I think it's probably easiest to start at the top guy. So this top guy, the sixth stage here, what is he doing? Remember, every period, first he takes 19 ounces of gold, and he uses it. He goes out in the labor market. He says, "Hey, I need some workers." And I say, "Yeah, well, if we're going to work for you, you better pay us wages." He says, "Yep, I got money." And then he also says, you know, if he's just having them go get the wheat with their bare hands. And then he goes up to the bunch, to the land, to the farmers, and says, "Hey, I see you own a bunch of land here." And they say, "Yep, I see there's wheat growing on it." And they say, "Yep." He says, "Tell you what, I want to pay you to let me have my men come in and grab that wheat with their bare hands and then take it away. How do you feel about that?" And they say, "Okay, well, if you pay us," they say, "Yep, here's what I'm going to pay you." All right, so the market prices that get established in those two markets are such that every period he pays total 19 ounces of gold. And then it takes time. It takes time for the workers to go out and collect all the wheat, bring it back, and then he brings it to market. And then the next period, that wheat that he's harvested, or that his workers have harvested, he turns around and sells for 20 ounces. So this happens period after period. So what does that mean? Every period, he's spending 19 to keep the workers happy and to keep the landowners happy, and yet the things they're producing, he's selling for 20. So that means every period, he's netting 1 ounce of gold, and that's why there's a one here in this box. Okay, so this is the thing that's different in this box compared to the one from last chapter. So before, remember in the last chapter, all the arrows were going up. You had all these arrows shooting up. But now, at each stage, you also have an arrow shooting off to the left. Okay, so forgive me, I'm going to walk through a couple of these because it's crucial that you understand. Like I said, everything depends on you understanding this chart. You'll understand savings and investment, and then you'll understand the business cycle later if you get this. Whereas if you don't really know how these numbers all relate to each other, it's going to be, there's no point even doing it. We might as well just do it in words. Okay, so again, this 20, remember, so it's not a coincidence that the 1 plus 19 equals 20. That's on purpose. And that's why he's shading this stuff, is to show you at each stage, that's always going to be the case. And this will make more sense as we do some more examples. Okay, so let's just keep following this thing chronologically. Okay, so now that guy has sold the raw wheat to the next stage. So now these next guys, the fifth stage capitalists, what do? Every period, now here, they don't start from scratch. Here, every period, they're already using capital goods. They spend 20 getting the wheat that was harvested by the other guy, by his operation. So you might say, well, wait a minute, how is wheat a capital good? That's a gift from nature. No, it's not. because the wheat that he's paying 20 for is not a gift of nature. It's nicely bundled and delivered in a very convenient form. The wheat that nature gives you is spread all out over the field in the hot sun, and it takes other resources to harvest it. That's what, in fact, I can tell you exactly how much it takes. It takes 19 ounces of gold to get that in your possession. Okay, so to have someone to go out and buy and have nice wheat bundled and put together in a very convenient, accessible form, that's not a gift of nature. That's a capital good, because nature doesn't give you wheat like that. Okay, so it's already been transformed by humans. So this person spends 20 for that, and then he also spends an additional 8 ounces of gold hiring more natural resources and more workers. So he spends every period 28, right? The 20 that he spends getting the wheat from the previous business, and then he also goes out into the labor market, hires workers, and hires, or buys, I should say, more natural resources from the people who own those things, whether it's land or mineral deposits or a fishery, whatever. Okay, so here now these workers aren't working with their bare hands. Right? They're now using capital goods. They're not just using the raw gifts of nature and their own labor power. Now these workers are using capital goods, things that have already been modified by other human beings in the past. And he turns around, this fifth order guy turns around and sells his product for 30. So why is he doing this? Well, notice that the what does he make each period? That's what this 2 is. Because this guy who sells the thing for 30 every period, what's he doing? He's spending 20 getting the capital good from the top, the highest guy, the sixth order guy, and he's spending an additional 8 getting more labor and natural resources. So that he's spending 28, and yet he sells his product for 30. So that's why every period he nets 2 ounces of interest income. Okay, let me just jump down to the last one, and then hopefully you will have seen the pattern. So this last one, how do you do that? The last stage, the guy who's the last capitalist to deal with things before selling it to the final customer, the consumer, remember, he spends 80 buying the, you know, the hunk of bread and the plastic, and then he spends an additional 15 to workers and landowners, so he spends 95 total. And then, but it takes time, remember, all these steps take time. And presumably they take a year, even though that's kind of unrealistic given the story I'm telling. But the idea is they all take the same length of time. So it takes time to transform this level, but when it's done, he can turn around and sell those finished, nicely sliced and packaged loaves of bread for a total of 100 ounces. So his total expenses were 80 plus 15 is 95. And so that's why there's a 5 right there. Because you see it's what it is each stage, the arrow that goes off to the left, the way you figure it out is you look at the number in that bar, and then you add up the numbers that are in the two bars above it. So notice these bars are not, the width doesn't mean anything. It's not that because this bar starts here and goes here, and there's this top line, this shaded bar starts here and goes here, and this other bar starts there and goes there. It's not that the width of both of those things means they're both the same. No, it's not. Because look, this one's 100, and this is 80 plus 15 is only 95. So the widths do not correspond to monetary value, even though at first glance it looks like they do. So that's the way you figure out what number goes in this box. It's the difference between that row's bar and then the sum of the two things above it. So here, like, why is there a 3 right there? Because this is 60 and this is 45 plus 12. So what's 45 plus 12 is 57. So 60 minus 57 is 3. So that's why there's a 3 right there. And why is there a 2 right there? Because there's 45 and then you do 30 plus 13 is 43, and 45 minus 43 is 2. So that's why there's a 2 right there. Okay, so again, what you're seeing there, those arrows going off to the left, are showing what the capitalists in each stage are earning on net. So if they just keep doing this period after period, they're deriving a sustainable income, because consistently what happens time after time is they can spend a certain amount of money buying capital goods from the previous stage capitalist, or not if it's the, if it's the highest order capitalist, because he doesn't deal with any other capitalists. But typically you spend some money buying capital goods from the prior stage, and you spend some more money hiring workers and buying more natural resources, and then the workers take the natural resources and the capital goods and work on them for a period, and then turn around and sell the output. And consistently, predictably, with pure certainty, you know you're going to be able to sell that output for more total money than the total amount of expenditures you had to make to be able to produce that thing. And so that's why consistently you see these flows of net income. Okay, so I see some people asking, does this just work in the ERE? Well, in the real world, Rothbard would say the economy tends towards this. So if you stop changing things and let the economy settle down, it would tend towards this. But in the real world, there's always disturbances because something new happens. Okay, but this is the final state towards which the whole economy tends to move. So that's why we're studying it now. We want to understand, if everything stayed the same, we just kept repeating, what principles are there? What would market prices look like? How do we figure out the ultimate source of rent and interest and the return to capital goods and things like that? And then once we get it down to ERE, then we start allowing uncertainty, and then we say, oh wait, now there's going to be profits and losses, and how does that change things, and so on. Okay, let me, now that you get a basic idea of how this chart works, what it's saying, let me skip ahead, and we're going to keep flipping back and forth, and we're going to start talking about, we're going to make observations about these numbers and their relationships, because I want you to see what things are arbitrary, that just because Rothbard picked those numbers, and what things are not a coincidence. Okay, so this is the facts about the economy of figure 41, the thing we were just looking at is figure 41 in the book. So the first thing to note is that you can look at that diagram and you can tell me what the interest rate is, or the pure rate of interest is, in that evenly rotating economy. Right? You might think, well, how can I do that? Don't we need to go look at the loanable funds market? No. And this is crucial that you understand this. So I'll tell you what the answer is, and then we'll go back and try to see how you get it. The interest rate is at about 5.2% per time period. So however long those stages take, the rate of return is 5.2% per that time period. So if it's a year, then the market rate of interest is a 5.2% annualized rate. So for example, this guy at the top, he's every period, remember, he invests 19 ounces of gold, and then one period later, he sells the output for 20 ounces of gold. So if you do the arithmetic on that, what that means is he earns one net ounce of interest income divided by an investment of 19. And that's about, it's actually 5.3%. But Rothbard's using nice round numbers. And so some of these things aren't actually, even with rounding, I said with rounding them, that's actually not correct. With rounding, it's 5.3. But the point is, they're all going to be roughly 5.2%. The reason they're not exact is that Rothbard didn't want to use decimal places. Okay, just so you know, the example that I give in the study guide, if you're using the study guide to go through this, later on when we do the effects of saving and investment, I came up with a new structure of production with different numbers. And in that one, I decided to have decimals, but then have the numbers be exact. Okay, so let me just say that all again. If you actually run the numbers and do the computations, you're going to say, wait a minute, Rothbard said the interest rate's 5.2%, but it's actually not, like in this first stage here, it's more like 5.3%. And again, that's because there's a trade-off. you can have nice round numbers in the picture, but then the math doesn't quite work out, or the math can work perfectly, but then you're going to have decimal places. And so he decided to have the nice round numbers. In contrast, in the example that I gave in the study guide, which I think is going to be for chapter 7, maybe chapter 8, off the top of my head, I forget. But anyway, I have a diagram that looks like this, but the numbers are different. We're showing what happens when households save more, save a higher fraction of their income, and the structure of production changes and the interest rate falls. The numbers I have there work out perfectly, but that's why they're messier. Okay, so let's just do a couple more and make sure you see the general pattern. So down here, what about this guy? He spends he spends 30 on the capital good and then 13 on hiring land and labor. So that means every period he's investing 43, and then a period later he sells it for 45. So he's earning 2 ounces of interest income. And let's see what his return is. So I'm going to say 2 divided by 43. Yeah, see, that one's not, that's only 4.7. So that's actually not. Unfortunately, Rothbard's not making my point here. All right, let's try this one. So here it's, he's earning 5 ounces on a capital investment of 95. And that's 5.26 again. Okay, so 5 divided by 95 is 5.26%. Okay, so anyway, that's, again, that's just a problem to trade off the Rothbard one, nice round numbers. All right, in theory, what's supposed to happen is the rate of return at each stage is supposed to be identical. In this particular numbers, they're actually not. It's above and below 5.2% for some of them, just because keep the numbers round. But the idea is, if you're a capitalist and you have gold that you're willing to invest, that you're willing to abstain from present consumption, and this is crucial. So these people, they, like this guy here, he could, if he wanted to, take this 19 ounces and go buy bread with it. He could try to eat more bread in this period, but he doesn't. He's farsighted. He's patient. He's willing to save and invest. So he abstains that 19 ounces that he could have spent on immediate consumption. Instead, he invests it by hiring workers and paying the landowner to let him harvest the wheat from his field. And then 1 year later, he sells the finished product for 20 ounces. And then he repeats the process. So he gets to use the 1 ounce of gold that he netted from that process. And so he can go to market and buy 1 gold ounce worth of bread. So he still is consuming. The point is, though, that every period he keeps reinvesting 19 ounces of gold. So his capital is 19 ounces of gold, and then he's earning 1 ounce net interest income on that, and the rate of return is 1 divided by 19, which is 5.26%. So the idea is, if he wanted to, he could say, well, why am I doing that? Why don't I get in this business down here, this industry down here, or this sector down here? And, you know, maybe he has lots of, or I'll just contribute. You know, I'll go up to this guy and say, hey, I want to get a piece of the action. The guy says, okay. And then, you know, what's the rate of return down here? Oh, but the rate of return is the same. If you invest your gold ounces down here by spending 80 and then 15 and waiting 1 year, you can sell it for 100, but the rate of return is the same because you had to spend more. So yeah, you can sell the thing for 100, whereas up here you could only sell it for 20, but your outlay is much higher. And so what matters to the capitalist is, where is the highest rate of return? And so the point is, in the ERE, no matter which stage you go in, the rate of return is going to be the same. Again, in these actual numbers, it's not identical, but that's just because he wanted to pick round numbers. Okay? So that's one thing. The rate of return is the same. And you can, for the Austrian view, the interest rate fundamentally is not, you don't figure out what the interest rate is by going to the loan market and seeing, oh, that guy wants to borrow $1,000 or 1,000 ounces of gold, and that guy's willing to lend it to him, but they're insisting on a 3% rate of interest. That's not the way the Austrians do it. They say, no, the rate of interest is determined in the product markets, in the production markets. And then the money rate of interest on loans is just an offshoot of that. That whatever you could earn through investment by putting your money into buying factors of production and then waiting for a time period and selling the product for a higher price, that rate of return gets pinned down by whatever, and then whatever that is, well, that has to be what's true in the loan market too, where you're literally just lending money to somebody, because if you could earn more in the product market, you would do that. Okay, let's keep going. What else can we observe about that chart? The sum of the capitalist and the factor owner's income equals total consumer spending. So here, this one, what is that? That is the net interest income that this capitalist earns every period. He spends 19, a year later he sells the output for 20, so that means every year, once he gets in that rhythm, every year he gets to consume forever 1 ounce worth of bread. The guy at this stage, what does he do? He spends 20 and 8 and then turns around and sells the thing for 30 a year later. So once he gets that rhythm going, every year he can consume 2 ounces worth of the finished bread. So 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 is 17. So the capitalists every year are netting a total of 17 ounces of gold in pure interest income. Whereas the labor land factors, let's see what their income sums to. So in this stage, what did the sixth order guy do? He pays 19 to land and labor owners. And he does that every period. This next guy, he spends 8. This next guy, he spends 13. So 19 plus 8 plus 13 plus 12 plus 16 plus 15 adds up to 83. And so that's what those up arrows are showing. All the up arrows added together is 83. So what I'm saying is 83 plus 17 adds up to 100, and that's not a coincidence. That's always going to be the case in the stationary, evenly rotating economy, that net income equals consumption expenditures, right? Because in the evenly rotating economy, you don't want to have net investment. Okay, you're only going to, every period, people are just going to spend enough, are just going to invest enough to maintain the capital structure the way it was the last period. And so that means any net income each period is going to be used for pure consumption. So if we're settled down in equilibrium, we're just doing the same thing over and over, that means every amount of net income each the different segments of the population earn has to all sum up to the total amount of consumption expenditures. So the idea is the capitalists every period earn collectively, adding up all these numbers, 17 ounces of net income, meaning if they just want to keep doing what they've been doing, they can afford to consume up to 17 ounces. The land and labor owners, their resources by definition just naturally replenish themselves period after period. So they can spend their entire incomes, or rather, all of their income is net income. Right, so the worker, his wages coming in are all net income, because that's normally the way we think about it. I mean, you could say, well, no, he's got to spend some money getting food or else he's going to die. But usually we just consider that consumption. We don't usually consider eating to be investment in your body. But if you wanted to think of it like that, you could. I'm just saying the way Rothbard's treating it, that's not the way he's doing it. He's saying a worker every period just naturally replenishes his productive powers. And so any wages he receives are pure net income that he can spend all on consumption if he wants. And then next period he'll be able to work again. And the same thing, the landowners in the ERE, their resources just keep replenishing themselves. They have to, otherwise it wouldn't be the ERE. So don't picture a coal miner who has a finite amount of coal, and then as he keeps selling it, now the supply dwindles and dwindles, because then that's not the ERE. Picture the owner of land and the wheat just keeps growing and every period he sells off the wheat, or the guy who owns a parcel of land and there's a factory that sits on it and every period he's just renting out that physical standing room, or the guy who owns a fishery and every period he rents out the right to take some of the fish, but then the fish naturally reproduce so that the stock of fish stays the same period after period. You know, think of stuff like that. Don't think of something that a depletable resource. Okay. So that's why the 17 plus 83 equals 100. Because remember, this is like the big circular flow of mainstream textbooks and so forth. We're seeing the whole picture and how it all fits together. Because these consumers, of course, they're not different people. It's not like they're immigrants who come in and have money from somewhere else. No, the consumers are the capitalists and the laborers and the landowners. So it has to be the case that the income earned by the different groups collectively is the total amount that's spent on consumption and net investment, but in this example there's no net investment. So the net income that everybody earns has to be spent entirely on consumption in order to keep this thing stationary. Okay, what else can we say? Total gross investment is 318 ounces. So let's make sure you see where that number's coming from. So here, do the consumers invest anything? No, they don't. The consumers, this 100 ounces that the consumers spend, just use, that's pure consumption. So they're not investing at all. What about this guy? Well, he invests, every period he invests 95 ounces. Because the 95 that he's spending, that's not on consumption, right? He consumes all right, but he only consumes five. So of his 100 ounces of revenue that he earns each period from selling all those loaves of bread, he consumes 5 of it, but the other 95 he reinvests back in the business. So that's definitely investment. That 95 that he's spending is definitely investment, and then notice that that's where this 95 came from. So that first 95 in those parentheses there, that's 80 plus 15. That's where I got that number. So that 95 is saying this lowest order capitalist, every period he's investing 95 ounces. He does it time and time again. So definitely investment, because he's not buying bread that he's going to eat with it. He's buying stuff for his business. But it's called gross investment because all he's doing is treading water. When he spends the 95 ounces, he's just doing that to maintain this perpetual flow of 5 ounces of net interest income. He has to spend 95 ounces period after period if he wants to maintain that 5 ounces of net income. If one period he just decides to have a party and he takes the 95 ounces of gold and buys a bunch of liquor and stuff with it, okay, he can do that. His consumption will be really high that period, but then next period he won't have any bread, finished loaves of bread to be able to sell to consumers. And so his income is going to drop to zero. Okay, so that's what's going on. And then I'll just do one more. This 76, where did that 76 come from? It's the 60 plus 16. Because every period, this capitalist invests 76 ounces of gold in his business. But again, it's not net investment. That's just what he needs to do if he wants to perpetually earn that 4 ounces of interest income. Okay, so if you add up all those numbers, so the 95 from this level, the 76 from this level, the, what is that, 57 from this level, and so on, the total you get is 318 ounces. So that's what the total gross investment is. Now, here's an interesting thing. If you take the gross investment and you multiply it by the interest rate, then that gives you the total income of the capitalists. So if you want to test that and see how it works, if you do 318 times 0.052, the answer is 16.536, which with rounding is 17. Okay, so again, that's not a coincidence. And if you just think through how it works, I'm not going to go through it now because we're running out of time, but if you just run through the numbers and see how that works, it'll make sense to you that that's got to be true. And it's literally true. With all these things, by the way, if you guys want to, somebody's asking here, do you ignore compounding? Rothbard maybe is, but I'm not. The compounding works in my example. Okay. In my example, these principles that I'm stating all work, you know, down to the at least the first decimal place. So if you're getting tripped up a little bit, you know, you can run the numbers in mine just to see these principles. Okay, and then also the net investment is zero in this economy. That'll make more sense when we I'm trying to think, how would you know? Would you know? I'm trying to think of just looking at this. Would you be able to tell that net investment was zero? Yeah, of course you would. The way you know net investment is zero is because net income is 100 and consumption is 100. So that's how you know that net investment is zero. Okay. Well, I think we've spent a lot of time on that. Let's move on. Capital goods and the ERE. So one of the main principles of the Austrian approach to capital interest theory is to say that capital goods and ERE don't earn any independent income or any net income. So they earn a gross income, but no net income. The only net income that accrues to the capitalists is due to the passage of time. So let's just go back and look at this real quickly. The idea here is, the reason, let's say this capitalist here, the reason he's able to consume 3 ounces of bread each period, it's not because his capital goods are productive per se. His capital goods are productive, don't get me wrong. He can sell them for 60 ounces of gold to somebody. Why is that person willing to pay 60? Because they're productive. You can produce more with them than without them, right? So that's why they command a market price. But the point is, this 3 ounces of gold in interest income that the capitalist is earning each period on net, that's not because of the productivity per se. That's because of time preference. That's because present goods are more valuable than future goods. If people had lower time preferences, then the spreads or the markups between each stage would be narrower. All right, so that's the idea that, this might make more sense in a couple minutes in this lecture. So if you're not quite getting what I'm saying, just hang on. I might clarify it from a different route in a few minutes. But just take my word for it right now. What Rothbard is getting at when he says capital goods don't actually earn a net income, only the productive original factors do. What he means is every period, if you're a natural resource owner or a laborer, that income that you earn is yours free and clear to consume. But if you're a capitalist, like this 100 ounces that you get, that's not net income. You can't just go ahead and blow that on consumption. If you do, what you've just done is consume mostly your capital, and then now your income down the road is going to plummet to zero. What you can consume free and clear is this number, this 5. And what that is, where that 5 is coming from, the 5 doesn't have to do with the productivity of your capital goods. The 5 is coming from the fact that this 100 is 5 more than the 80 plus the 15. Right? So the 5 is not due to the fact that this is 100, because what if this had been 80 and 19? Then that 5 would have been a 1. Okay, so you can see what the reason the capitalists earn a net income is that for some reason, that spread maintains itself. For some reason, they are able to consistently spend less total money on the inputs than what they think they're going to be able to sell the output for 1 year later. And that fact, that spread, or that discount on the present goods, or sorry, on the future goods, is due to time preference. It's not due to the productivity of capital. Like I said, we're going to hit this from a different angle, so it might make more sense in a few minutes. But I just want to point this, what Rothbard's getting at here. What is it that the capitalists do in the ERE? Why is it that they're earning an income? It's because they advance present goods to the workers and to the landowners, and they're willing to wait. and that's why they earn a net income. So here, and then I think we're actually done with this slide, believe it or not. I think it's easiest to do with this top guy. So this top guy, why is it that year after year he gets to eat one gold ounce worth of bread? Why does he get to do that? What role is he contributing? He's not doing anything. He's not going out in the field picking wheat with his hands. He doesn't even own any land. His only contribution is that he had 19 gold ounces, and then he was willing to wait a year. That is the only thing he did. Okay, and so you can see here, this is, you remember when, well, for those of you who are taking the Keynes class, you remember Keynes was worried about the rentier and the guy who just, you know, the fat cat capitalist who just sits back and just lives off interest income. I mean, this is why Marxists and then even Keynes himself are suspicious of capitalists. It seems like they're parasites. You can understand why the worker gets paid an income. You can also understand why the landowner gets paid an income. You might think it's unfair, but you can say, all right, well, if we're going to have private property and you own scarce real estate or you own a fishery or whatever, okay, fine. You know, that is scarce, and that's why there's a return to that factor. But it's hard for a lot of people to understand and to justify why is it that these capitalists sit back and get 17 ounces of consumption every period. So remember, there's a certain amount of bread that's coming out the pipeline. And you can see the workers every period. You know, some workers are out in the fields picking wheat with their bare hands. Other workers are taking the bundled wheat and they're doing something to it. Other workers are millers and they're taking the wheat and turning it into flour. Other workers are bakers and they show up day after day and take the flour and turn it into a big hunk of bread. Other workers take the bread and they slice it up. So you can see what the workers are doing. You can see what the landowners are doing. The guy who owns the field, the guy who owns whatever, I didn't make up the other stuff, whatever minerals are used to make the plastic, okay? You can see their contribution. But then you say, why is it these capitalists are getting 17% of the total output every period? What are they doing? Because they're not lifting a finger. They're just sitting around eating bread all day. What are they doing? So the Austrians say what they're doing is they are allowing the workers and the landowners to eat earlier than the bread that they're producing is physically available. Okay, because what happens is, for example, if this top order guy here, when he pays 19 ounces to the workers and the guys who own the fields, that 19 ounces, they go to the store right away and they buy bread with it. But, and they can say, oh, we're doing that because what we're producing is nice bundled bread that can be sold to somebody else for 20 ounces of gold. So that's why what we're producing. But you say, wait a minute, but what you've produced right now is not 20 ounces worth of product. You're actually only producing something that next year will be worth 20 ounces. We still have to wait a year. And so because of time preference, that's not the same thing. Maybe it's easier. Let's do this. We'll go to the last stage. The guy who buys a hunk of bread and plastic and hires workers and pays them only 95, even though when their stage is done, you've got the 100 loaves of bread. You could say, why is it that that capitalist is getting 5 loaves of bread? What's he doing? And he could say, oh, what I'm doing is when I pay these guys 95, they, that period, get to go to the store and buy 95 ounces. Well, no, they don't buy 95 because this capitalist reinvests most of it. The 15, let's focus on the 15. At 15, what are they doing? They get to go to the store right away and buy 15 fresh loaves of bread that are already sliced up and packaged that day when they work, whereas what they're doing, the bread they're physically producing, won't be ready until next year. Okay, so that's what the capitalists are doing. It's a little bit tricky to see that once we're in long-run equilibrium and everything repeats itself. But it's easier to see that process if you imagine starting from scratch and then the things start, you know, rolling over, that if you were paying the workers and they were able to go and spend the money, they would be eating before the bread became physically available, right? So they would have to be eating bread that was previously produced. Okay, so that's the idea. And this is all like the classical conception, just the Austrians refined it. Okay, that the role, what the capitalists are doing is they are advancing consumption goods. So think of it, if you want, this is the way that the classical economists pictured it. They pictured the capitalist as literally stockpiling consumption goods. And then they would go up to the workers and literally give them food and clothing and shelter, and the workers would produce stuff that wouldn't turn into ready for consumption, food and clothing and shelter until the future. And so that's what the capitalists were doing. They were giving it in advance. So that's the contribution of the capitalist. And so if you agree that time preference is a real thing, that it genuinely is the case that present goods are worth more than future goods, well, then that's why the capitalists earn income. And there's nothing immoral about that. That they are giving the workers something more valuable. Because when a worker produces something, it's, you know, if you really want the worker to get the full value of his product, you say, no, I want the worker to retain everything. I don't want those capitalists skimming off the top. You say, okay, but then that means if you're a worker in a coal mine, you don't get anything for 20 years because the coal that you're helping to bring to the surface might not actually yield an increase in consumption goods until 20 years from now. Or if you're, you know, working and bringing some mineral to the surface. So, yeah, if you're willing to wait 20 years, you're going to have a heck of a lot of consumption goods coming out of the pipeline, but most workers aren't willing to wait because they want to consume before that. So that's what it is the capitalists do, is they say, we'll give you an advance on what we think your product is eventually going to yield in terms of consumer goods down the road. And since people have time preference, they're willing to pay a premium on present consumption. So that's what's going on. And that's the role of the capitalist. So again, it's, well, why don't we just keep moving on, and it'll be clearer when I do it this way. Okay, so now the last section here, I won't spend too much time on this, but I just want to give you historically, I'm getting a little bit mixed up. When the TAs, remind me, we end at 30 after, right? Can somebody confirm that? Okay. All right, so I got about 8 minutes left if I want to leave 15 minutes for questions. That's good. Okay, so here what I'm doing is I'm going to just give you a brief overview of the historical development of capital and interest theory in the Austrian tradition. So these three guys are Bombaberg, Frankfurter, and Ludwig Mises. Okay, so Bombaberg, and by the way, I didn't have time to fix it, but these O's and Bombaberg's last name should have the two dots above them. But I was running against the wire. It came down to the wire, and I didn't have time to fix that. Okay, so Eugen von Bombaberg, who is he? He was, hang on, we're getting overhead lighting issues. Kind of looks like I'm a saint or something. Bombaberg was Menger's, was the successor to Menger. Right? So Karl Menger was the founder of the Austrian school. Bombaberg and von Weiser were like the second generation Austrians. And then Mises was a third generation. Okay, so Bombaberg generally is credited as being one of the pioneers in interest or capital and interest theory, even among mainstream economists. Okay, so like even Irving Fisher, who I think most mainstream economists now would say is the king and gave us modern interest theory, if you go read Fisher's classic works, I don't remember if he actually dedicates them to Bombaberg and this guy John Ray, but I think he might. Okay, but in any event, the point is, this isn't just like me as an Austrian touting our guys. I mean, everybody agrees that this guy Bombaberg was huge in the development of interest theory. Okay, so how did he approach the problem? He said, okay, why is it that the capitalist can regularly earn an income, a net income, even though it doesn't appear that they're contributing anything productive? So this is kind of like going back to what I was talking about before. I was intentionally trying to frame the problem there to make it look like a puzzle. Because once we frame it that way, you'll see that Bhavar, you know, really gives the only explanation that makes any sense. But until you frame the question properly, you're not going to be able to come up with the answer. And I don't have this typed out, but let me rephrase it. Specifically, he said, why is it that a capitalist can take a certain amount of money, go into the factor markets, hire labor, hire natural resources, buy other capital goods, and he can, and the prices are such that he knows that the total he spends on all those productive factors after they do their work and make the finished product and he sells it down the road, he's going to get a higher revenue than the total amount of money he had to spend creating the product. And Bhavar says, you know, that's not due to chance. It's not just that it happens once in a while. We all know regularly this happens all the time. And capitalists can count on the fact that they're going to earn a net income from doing this. And so he said, why is that? Why isn't it the case that the productive factors don't, you know, why don't we see their prices get bid up to erase that interest income? So now Bhavar went through and cataloged all the various theories of interest that had been offered up to that point, and he tried to systematically just blow them all up. I mean, it's really an amazing approach to economic theory, where he just goes through and classifies all the existing theories and then critiques them all and then gives his own explanation. All right, so one of the ones that's particularly relevant for modern Austrians, for our story, one of the theories that he critiques, he called the naive productivity theory. So again, so you don't get lost here, Bhavar sets up the interest problem. He says, why is it that we have this phenomenon called interest? Why can capitalists who have accumulated financial capital, who have money that they can invest if they want, why do they have the ability to invest it and consistently reap a net income from that year after year? Why is that possible? And so now he's going to say there's one explanation called the naive productivity, what Bhavar's calling the naive productivity theory, that, as the name suggests, Bhavar doesn't think is very good. So let me just explain what this theory said, and then you'll see Bhavar's critique, and then you'll understand why I did that in a couple of minutes from now. But for right now, let's just follow the train of thought. The naive productivity theory says, oh, the reason capitalists can do that, the reason you can spend a certain amount of money on capital goods, use them to help make more of a product, and then sell the product for more total money than you pumped into the project, is that capital goods are productive. And if you press them, you say, well, what do you mean? You say, oh, well, you know, you can produce more with capital goods than without. That's what it means. That's why they're productive. But that's not a good explanation. The fact that capital goods are physically productive, the fact that you can produce more output with capital goods than you can without them, that's true and it's important, but that explains their rental price. And it also explains why they have a positive purchase price. Okay, but that doesn't explain why there's interest income. And the way to see that is, look at a specific example. So here, for the people who are following after the fact, now I'm looking at the slide that says naive productivity theory continued. Let's imagine there's a home builder and he's got $100,000 of capital, financial capital, money. So what does he do? He buys a parcel of land. There's the actual plot of land itself, the natural resource. He hires some workers who are good at construction, and he buys capital goods. He buys, you know, the raw lumber, he buys nails, he buys whatever, glass, sheets of glass, aluminum siding, and so forth. And he spends a total of $100,000, and then let's say it takes him a year. A year later, you know, he builds the thing, and then after marketing and whatever, the deal finally closes, and he sells the house for $110,000. So this capitalist has earned net income of $10,000. So he's earned a 10% return on his money because he put in $100,000, he got out $110,000 a year later at the $10,000 net rate of return per year. All right. So if we assume there wasn't any risk involved, this was just a surefire thing, then you would say the pure rate of interest here, and prices were the same, but, you know, the purchasing power money didn't change. You'd say the pure rate of interest here was 10%. So now Bombaverick is saying, to explain why is that the case, why was this capitalist able to take his $100,000, invest it for a year, and then yield $10,000 of income that he could go consume if he wants. He can spend the $10,000 on getting steak dinners and playing, you know, video games and whatever, going to movies. Why does he get to do that even though he hasn't worked himself? Bombaverick is saying, it's no explanation. Don't tell me it's because backhoes are physically productive. Don't tell me that. He's saying, because the fact that backhoes are physically productive and that I can build more houses per year using backhoes than without, that's true and that's important, but that explains the rental price of a backhoe. And that explains why I'm willing to pay money to buy backhoes. But it doesn't explain why this number here of 100,000 is less than this number here of 110,000. Because if I didn't know any better, if you tell me that this finished house sells for $110,000, and you tell me that we have the technological know-how, that if I buy this plot of land, I hire these workers with these certain skills, and I buy this backhoe or I rent it from some company that rents out construction vehicles, and then I'm going to be able to combine all this stuff and 1 year later sell the finished product for $110,000, well, then why doesn't competition among me and other capitalists, why doesn't that bid up this price of $100,000 to $109,000 and ultimately to $110,000? Okay, so that was the problem. And Bombaverick was saying, you telling me this backhoe is productive, you're missing the point. The question isn't why is this number positive. The question is why is it so low? So the productivity explanation actually, not only is it irrelevant, it's almost the opposite of what you need. What we're trying to explain is why these factors of production seem to be undervalued compared to what they're eventually going to yield. That's the problem. And that's how the capitalist earns his income. It's the gap between this price and this price is where the net income is coming from. So Bombaverick's explanation, he said present goods are preferred to a like kind and quantity of future goods. And that once you realize that, that solves everything. So let me just quickly show you how that works. So here, what if I tell you that somebody, yeah, it's true, somebody was willing to pay $110,000 for this kind of house right now. But what if instead of that house, what I'm selling to you is an airtight claim to that house, but you can't move in until 12 months from now? Well, if present goods are preferred to future goods, people would pay less for that claim than they would pay for the house right now. Because basically what I'm selling you is the house available in exactly 1 year. Whereas if you buy the house outright, you get the house right now. So if present goods are more valuable than future goods, that means the price I would pay for that claim, you know, there's no doubt about the validity of the claim. The person's not going to default on it. But the point is, I have to wait 12 months before I take possession of the house. So if present goods are more valuable than future goods, then I won't pay the same amount for the claim as I would pay for the house. So I think you see where this is going. Well, what if the degree of that preference for present versus future goods is such that in equilibrium, consumers pay $110,000 for this house on the spot market to be able to move in right away, but they only pay $100,000 for the right to be delivered this kind of house 12 months from now? Well, then, if that's the explanation, then you can see why this number is only $100,000. Because this plot of land and this backhoe and the other construction equipment and these workers and their skills, those aren't actually the same thing as a house available right now. What they are is like a technological claim on a house available 12 months from now, because I said it takes a year for them to build the thing and sell it. So if you understood before why, just looking to consumers, they would spend $110,000 for this house right now, but they would only spend $100,000 for a piece of paper saying 1 year from now you get to move into this house and own it, then you can see why capitalists would not bid this price up above $100,000. And now we just solve the problem. But notice the explanation here for why the capitalist can spend $100,000 here and then a year later turn around and sell the thing for $110,000. That had nothing to do with the physical characteristics of the capital goods. It was entirely due to the consumer's subjective preferences, you know, their willingness to wait or their desire to move in earlier. That's where those numbers came from, the difference. Okay, now I'm not going to get into this. I'm just going to state the fact. Bumbavard went further. He didn't just stop with this observation that present goods are preferred to a like kind and quantity of future goods. He said, now, if that's true, then that solves the interest problem. But he said, but why is it true? And so he tried to then go on and explain why is it the case that present goods are preferred to future goods. And one of the reasons he gave is that he said roundabout processes of production have a higher technical productivity, or they're more physically productive. And so factors of production that you get earlier are more technically productive than factors of production that you don't get your hands on until later, because the earlier you get them, you can invest them in longer and longer and more roundabout processes. So that's why Bumbavard thought you're always better off getting a factor of production sooner rather than later, because if you want the output sooner, then you can get it sooner. But even if you're willing to wait, you can always have more if you have an earlier, if you get possession of a factor of production earlier, because you can then get it going and it can be invested in a longer process compared to some factor of production that you're not going to get your hands on until the future. Okay, this is extremely complicated. If I'm losing you, don't worry about it. I'm not going to test you on this. I just want you guys to understand what happened historically. So that's what Bumbavard was doing. He said, first and foremost, how do you explain interest? It's because present goods are subjectively valued more than future goods, end of story, as far as the interest problem. But now you ask me, wait a minute, Bumbavard, but why should it be the case that present goods are preferred to future goods? And then he gave some various reasons. One reason was that he said present goods were more technically productive than future goods. Okay, so now, moving along, what did Frank Fetter have to say? Well, and incidentally, Fetter didn't consider himself an Austrian economist. He considered him part of what was called the psychological school, but he was very Austrian in his views, and so that's why modern Austrians kind of consider him one of their own. So he loved what Bumbavard did. He adored Bumbavard's framing of the interest problem and the critiques he leveled against the productivity theory, the naive productivity theory. But Fetter said, wait a minute. But then at the last minute, Bumbavard slipped up. After he demolished the productivity explanation and showed how interest was due to the preference of present over future goods, for some reason, Bumbavard let the productivity explanation come in through the back door. So what's he doing? Bumbavard, you slipped up, man. I, Frank Fetter, am going to explain interest solely as the result of subjective time preference. The fact that present goods are more valuable than future goods, that explains interest. End of story. The productivity of capital goods has nothing to do with it. And then Mises comes along and says, yep, Fetter's entirely right. Bumbavard made a great start. He really cleared up the confusion. He accurately stated the problem, but alas, at the last minute, his own explanation was susceptible to the very criticisms he himself had launched against others. Isn't that a shame? And so I, Ludwig von Mises, agree with Frank Fetter that interest is all about time preference, nothing else. Productivity of capital has nothing to do with it. The one part where Mises differed with Fetter, though, better thought that time preference was just an empirical regularity. They're just, in this world, human beings happen to have time preference. Whereas Mises said, no, that's not true. That human action itself, or action itself, requires positive time preference. Okay, so Mises thought the very notion of action, when you think through the consequences of it, implies that other things equal, people prefer present goods over future goods. And so Mises took Fetter's approach, but just made it praxeologically more airtight in his mind, because Fetter left it open, hey, maybe there could be negative time preference, maybe, you know, Martians might have it or something. And Mises was saying, no, any acting being that is using means to achieve ends, by its very nature, if it's trying to achieve an end, wants to achieve the end sooner rather than later. And so that's time preference. And so, you know, interest is a fundamental part of action itself. Okay, well, let me turn to your question. So there, this is a very big and complicated area, especially with the stuff with von Bawerk. If I lost you a little bit, don't worry. This is truly, people have referred to capital and interest theory as the black hole of economics. Right. So what I just did, in case you're concerned, some of you may know, I personally don't like Mises' treatment of interest theory. But I put that aside. What I just taught you guys is canonical stuff. Okay, I just gave you the standard Misesian story of the progression of the history of interest theory in the Austrian tradition. Okay, so don't worry that, oh my gosh, do I have to go check with Joe Salerno? Did this guy Murphy just tell me something crazy? What I just taught you guys is standard stuff. That's the way Mises would have explained. Let me put it that way. I don't think Mises, if he were alive and heard what I just said, would have any problem with what I just said, or at least that's what I was trying to do. Even though I personally have quibbles with some of that stuff. So I didn't bring up any of that stuff. What I just gave you guys is the canonical version and what Murray Rothbard, I would like to think, would have signed off on. Okay. Let's see. So now let's go to your questions. And I'll go, they made another 8 minutes, so I'll go to 35 after, because I kind of went long, assuming you guys have questions. Okay, man, I have a ton of tabs in my Firefox here, so hang on. Okay, I'm going to have to sign in, no doubt. Okay, sorry, it's taking forever to reload. Okay, and what are we on, week two? Almost there. Feel free to make a time preference joke. Wow, this is taking a while. I've clicked on the questions for the professor thing, and it's just taking a long time to load. Is anybody else in that thing? If you are, if you want to post one of the questions in the chat box, and I can get started on it, because it's just, it's not loading on my thing. Okay, Nathaniel Stover says, you said that the interest rate is set in the production market and the loan markets simply borrow the interest rate from the production market. Why? Don't all consumption borrowers as well as business investors participate in the market's rate of interest based on the time preferences of all those market participants? Yes, that's true. So this, and again, it's here I'm skirting the fine line and trying to teach you what the standard Austrian position is versus my own views. So I agree with you. I never found that particularly compelling, but what I am saying is von Bawerk, Rothbard, and Mises all thought that the interest, the pure rate of interest, what von Bawerk called the originary rate of interest, was determined by the capitalists in the product markets, and that the money contractual rate of interest was just an offshoot of that. So I don't recall them ever saying why they thought that, but they do say that. I know for sure von Bawerk says it. I'm 99% sure Rothbard says it, and 99% sure Mises says it. So I don't know why, but they do clearly think that the interest rate is determined in the structure of production, and then, oh yeah, because of arbitrage, that's what the rate's got to be for people who want to borrow money itself. Okay. Okay, that's enough questions, guys, because I'm not gonna be able to answer all these. So thank you for posting these. Let me just do some of them. Okay, Jacob C. asks, on page 388, Rothbard says, every individual has a similar type of time market schedule. The schedule of each will be such that at lower, actually, now my thing is loaded. Let me just do it over here, because now I can't see because you guys are bumping around. Okay, so Jacob says, quoting Rothbard, every individual has a similar type of time market schedule. The schedule of each will be such that at lower rates of interest, the individual becomes a net demander. And then, now this is Jacob talking again. I assume this is just a slip, as there will certainly be individuals who are not net demanders at any positive interest rate, correct? Like John Smith on page 380 or Jim Bob and Michelle Duggar? I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something. Why don't we wait till we'll cover this stuff in next week's lecture, Jacob. So why don't you wait until I go over that, and then if I don't remember, just jog my memory and I'll come back and try to answer your question. But I'm going to specifically cover this stuff in these diagrams and whatever next week's lecture. So I think it makes more sense for me to answer it then. A lot of questions from Jacob. Okay. Okay, here's one. So Jacob says, I think I get the larger point Rothbard is making on page 398, but there's one thing I just can't get my head around. He says, quote, total expenditures on production are, colon, 100, and then in parentheses, consumption, plus 318, dot, dot, dot. So now this is Jacob talking again. How does it make sense to count consumption expenditures as production expenditures? Is he referring to the fact that even for the consumers, the good themselves are not the desired end, but means the production of the satisfaction, which is their true end? I mean, you can think of it like that, but I think you're reading too much into it. What Rothbard's trying to get at is how much total output is there each period? And the point is, a Keynesian might look at that and say, oh, there's only 100, gross domestic product is, well, I'm not sure what a Keynesian, yeah, I think he would say the gross domestic product is only 100. But the point is that no, actual production and output is 418. Because really every period there's 100 spent on consumption goods that are produced, and there's 318 that are spent on production goods. So he's not saying that the loaves of bread or whatever are production goods. He's saying, though, that they were produced. So the people who spend 100 ounces on them are spending on production, things that were produced. That's what I think Rothbard means there. So you're right. It might be a little bit confusing if you think he's calling them production goods. They're not production goods. They're consumption goods. But his point is they had to have been produced. So that's part of output. So what he's trying to get you to see there is And I might as well make this point now, because this is crucial. So let's go back to that diagram that maybe you're completely sick of at this point. In this diagram here, to keep things going, the beauty of this diagram is it shows perfectly why the Austrians think the Keynesians are crazy. Because you look at this diagram, a Keynesian might say, uh-oh, in order to keep this thing going, those consumers better spend that 100 ounces. In this economy, this is maybe one way to put it, right? I'm pretty sure this is right. I believe if you did the standard Keynesian accounting, national income accounting, I'm pretty sure this is right. You would look at this and you would say, oh, GDP every period is 100 ounces, and it is driven entirely by consumption. The Y equals 100 ounces is Y equals C plus I plus G plus net exports. Well, in this economy, there's no net exports. This is just a closed system. There's no government, so G is zero. There's no net investment expenditures, so that's zero. And everything that's produced is consumer goods. And everybody, every period, just spends all of his net income on consumption. And so the economy is not growing. It's just stationary, and consumption drives everything. And so we better make sure we keep that consumption up there. Otherwise, the economy is going to fall apart. And so Rothbard is going to say, no, it's not. And this is also, Mark Skousen is actually really good on this point. If you guys know who Mark Skousen is, this is something that he really emphasized that I think other Austrians didn't really, it's in Rothbard. I'm talking about it right now. It's in Rothbard, but my point is just it didn't click for me really until Skousen just beat the heck out of it. What's keeping this economy going is all these capitalists keep reinvesting period after period. So yeah, that's not the I, and I'm hesitant because I'm not 100% sure, but I'm almost positive that in the Keynesian accounting, national accounting things, that I stands for net investment. I don't think it stands for gross investment. And so here, so when they, I'm sure of that because that's Skousen's whole point. When they do GDP and they say, oh, consumer expenditures are 70% of GDP, and that's why the consumer drives the economy, and that's why to get out of this recession, we need the consumer to get back in the game. That figure where they get the 70%, they're comparing consumption to net investment. So here, now I'm certain. Here, they would say in this economy, consumption is 100% of GDP. So they would, the Keynesian framework would lead you to believe that there's no investment going on at all, and that this is all just driven purely by consumption, when in fact, no. 100 ounces is consumption and 318 ounces is invested every period. So that's what Rothbard is getting at when he's saying the point is of 418 ounces that are spent each period buying stuff, 318 ounces are spent buying factors of production, and only 100 ounces are spent buying consumption goods. And so that just shows you how the Keynesian view is totally messed up and that the Austrian view gives you a much more accurate picture. So really what's keeping this economy going, yes, you do ultimately need the consumers to want the bread. That's the whole point of it. You're not producing for the sake of producing. You're producing for the sake of satisfying consumer preferences. But the point is it takes 6 years for this thing to get online. And once it is going, you have to have the capitalist each period plowing back the lion's share of the revenues into the business to replenish their capital stocks to be able to do it all again the next period. And if they didn't do that, if instead they decided to blow, if they listen to the Keynesians, now we got to stop. So I will answer your guys' questions, but this is a pretty important point here. I'm getting excited just thinking about it. If you use the Keynesian framework and you look at this economy, you would say, holy cow, consumption is 100% of this economy. Everybody should just go and consume as much as they can, and then they'll grow the economy. But if all these capitalists at these various stages, if they said, oh, okay, Paul Krugman just said the way to grow the economy is to consume more, and they went to the store and they tried to spend more of their stuff on bread, and they didn't invest it, well, what would happen? That would just push up the price of bread, and then without making those investments, the next period the capital stock would be lower. So like let's say every period, let's say right now all the capitalists, they only reinvested 90% of what they normally did, and the other 10% they used and tried to go to the retail sector and buy more bread. A Keynesian might say, oh, that's great. That's going to push up the price of bread. So now the bread producers are going to be able to then buy more stuff from the guys at the previous stage, and boom, 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 and the economy will grow because now we've got bigger final demand. And Rothbard's point is, no, it won't. There's not more loaves of bread to go around just because people want to spend more money on it. There's only enough bread as what has been physically produced. So if everybody tries to go to the store and exchange more gold for bread, yeah, the price of bread's going to go up in that last stage, but we're not going to have more bread. It's just the price is going to go up. And then you can say, oh, but won't that stimulate more production? He's going to say, no, it can't, because now this higher order good, you know, that guy, instead of spending 19 ounces, maybe he only spent 18 ounces. And he tried, instead of spending one on consumption, he tried to spend two. And so now he hired fewer workers and fewer labor resources. So going forward, this period, less wheat was actually collected. And the same thing is true of the miller and the baker and so forth. That they're actually doing, they invested less in their business this period because they wanted to use some of their income, some of their gross income, to consume more. So there's no way around that physical reality. If all the capitalists spent less on getting real physical goods in motion, I don't care how much gold coins we're willing to offer next year or 3 years from now to the retailers, they're not going to have the bread to give to us. So yeah, nominal expenditures might go up, but so will prices. And you'll see real output is going to drop, because we foolishly let our capital structure get dilapidated because we diverted resources out of gross investment and into consumption. So if we're doing that because of a change in preferences, because our time preferences go up, okay, that's fine. That we want to consume more now and consume less in the future, we can do that. But the point is, don't let the Keynesians fool you. You don't get something for nothing. We can't just permanently have a higher amount of bread shooting out because we decide to spend more money. No, the way you get more bread is you have to harvest more wheat. And the way you harvest more wheat, unless you come up with a technological discovery, or unless we find more productive wheat fields, or unless we find workers who are faster for some reason, the way you get more wheat is to save more, to spend less on consumption up front, and then to hire more workers or to plow more into your business. That's the idea. Okay, so why don't we stop there, and like I said, I will get caught up with your questions, and tomorrow, Thursday, I will post the quiz and so forth and send you the email about that. All right, thanks, everybody. Thanks for staying up and watching this.